I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour has written a fascinating book that looks at the whole over 240-year history of how we have decided who should vote in this country. And, of course, there have been more than a few controversies, including in 2016. Michael Waldman is our guest. The book is The Fight. Actually, right is slashed out and F is put in there to vote. And Michael is here to talk about all that he's discovered and some really interesting history here. Michael is, since 2005, he's been the president of the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU School of Law. The center is a very important voice on election law, constitutional law, government reform, and racial justice. He is a constitutional lawyer and a writer. He's an expert on the presidency and American democracy. He was director of speech writing for President Bill Clinton from 1995 to 1999, served as assistant to the president, and was responsible. Get this, if you've ever thought about how hard it is to put together a speech, he wrote or edited nearly 2,000 speeches. Holy Toledo, that's a lot, including 4 State of the Union and 2 inaugural addresses. He's also author of many other books, including The Second Amendment, a biography, and many other books. And we'll be welcoming phone calls for him because there's so much to talk about. The Founding Fathers, what they had in mind, Frederick Douglass seeing the right to vote for African Americans as the next step after slavery. The, you know, I think kind of forgotten history of women's right to vote in this country. Fascinating chapters on that. Of course, what happened with the 15th Amendment. And then we have the Civil Rights Movement and the right to vote, Lyndon Johnson and the marches in this country and Dr. Martin Luther King and what's happened in the last 15 years, which he finds rather troublesome. So a lot to cover with Michael. Hello, Michael. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hi, my pleasure. Hi. Thank you so much.
2,000 speeches? Are you serious? That's a lot, isn't it?
President Clinton once introduced me as the person who typed his speeches, so I like your introduction better.
Yeah, I'll bet.
When I left the White House, my colleagues gave me a T-shirt with what they said was the symbol of the speechwriting department, and it was the recycling symbol.
Oh, Michael, I'm so glad you wrote this book. It's just, it's good, and I haven't a chance to read all of it because I was doing Super Tuesday last night until midnight, but I have read good chunks of it, and it's so well done. Let's go back over 240 years because this whole idea of shaping a new system of elections and this whole idea of creating a government, the founders seemed to be of very different minds as to where voting was going to take place and certainly different minds as to who was going to vote.
Well, you're exactly right. And one of the reasons I wanted to write the book was to learn the history myself even more, being in the middle of today's fights. And it has always been like this. And it turns out that throughout 240 years, it's always been a fight to vote. There have been people who've had to demand their voice be heard. There were others who were fighting against them, and it's always been very raucous and often partisan and raw. And you're right that at the very beginning, the United States was not a democracy in any way that we would understand it. They had some ideas, as articulated, for example, in the Declaration of Independence, that government was legitimate, as Jefferson put it, only when it was based on the consent of the governed. He wrote that while being attended by a 14-year-old slave boy, of course.
Right.
But the rule was in those days that the only people who could vote were white men who owned property, a certain amount of property. And that was kind of the way it was. That was how it had been inherited from England. But even then, so that was only a small segment of the public, even then, there were people who were pushing for more, and one of the heroes who came forward in this in the way I hadn't realized was Ben Franklin.
Yes,
he led a working man's revolt in Pennsylvania in 1776 to demand voting rights regardless of property. And at the Constitutional Convention, they didn't ever talk about who could vote in the Constitution. The original Constitution doesn't say who could vote or if you have a right to vote. And they discussed it and debated it. And Franklin blocked all the efforts to try to put that property requirement into the Constitution. But there were a lot of the other framers and founding generation were very nervous about democracy. John Adams wasn't there at the Constitutional Convention, but John Adams was urged to support expanding voting rights, and he was aghast. He said, women will demand
a vote. Oh, yes. Remember the ladies, though.
Abigail told him. His wife said,
"Yeah,
women will demand a vote. Lads will think their interests not sufficiently attended to. And men who have not a farthing to their name will think themselves worthy of having a voice in government." And he said, "There will be no end of it." And of course, that's exactly what happened.
Yeah. Do you have your book in front of you?
I do indeed.
You do?
Yes.
Oh, good. Would you read? Because I read this to several people. I just thought this was great. What Benjamin Franklin said about men with property only voting. It's on page 15. I just thought it was brilliant.
Yeah. So Franklin said, "Today a man owns a jackass worth $50, and he is entitled to vote. But before the next election, the jackass dies. The man, in the meantime, has become more experienced. His knowledge of the principles of government and his acquaintance with mankind are more extensive, and he is therefore better qualified to make a proper selection of rulers. But the jackass is dead, and the man cannot vote. Now, gentlemen, pray inform me, in whom is the right of suffrage? In the man or in the jackass?"
I love that. Isn't that great?
I think that says it pretty well.
I know.
And of course, you know, as we wrestle with issues, one of the things that I found in looking at the history is the book is principally about who can vote. But issues of wealth in the elections, and even up till now with Citizens United and its aftermath, and things we think of as campaign finance, they were entwined from the beginning. And that fight over the property requirement really is the same fight.
Mm-hmm. So when do we reach a point, and who led the banner to make sure that at least white men, all of them, could vote? Who championed that?
Well, it was another bit of a surprising hero in this is political parties. So the first breakthrough came when they expanded the right to vote to all white men, regardless of property. In other words, the white working class, who's such a focus right now, was the first voting rights breakthrough. And it happened around the country, but pretty much in the 1820s. The Democratic Party organized for this vote and this right to vote. And it was it wasn't sort of a citizens' movement with people marching in the streets. It was often party politicians, insiders, like Martin Van Buren of New York.
I never knew that. Martin Van Buren.
Well, and he was sort of Andrew Jackson's lieutenant.
Uh-huh.
He fought to get the right to vote to the people he said who were the pith and muscle of America. And democracy really took off in the United States in a much wider way than it had happened anywhere else. I mean, this was the Democrats then were the first mass political party in the world. Democracy sort of became a fad almost. It was very participatory. Elections were parades and fist fights and a lot of violence at the polling place. And turnout among the men who were eligible to vote was very, very high.
Mm-hmm. Moving ahead, because we have a lot of territory, and then we'll have our audience center on what they want to talk about. Let's talk about voting rights for freed slaves, from male freed slaves. Do you really think that, as you write, John Wilkes Booth was really moved to murder by Lincoln's seeming change of heart on voting? Is that what prompted him to go to the theater and kill him?
Well, you know, I don't think Booth was a big Lincoln fan before that.
No.
but it is the case that Lincoln had not been for voting rights for African Americans previously. And in fact, his first stabs at Reconstruction did not enfranchise the former slaves. But a few days after the surrender at Appomattox, he stood in a second floor window at the White House and read a speech and said, "You know, I've been criticized on this, and I now think the critics are right. We should expand voting rights to all the people who've served in the military and the educated." And he actually gave indications that he would go even further. Booth was there and gasped and said, "That means citizenship. That is the last speech he will ever give."
Hmm.
And he actually tried to get the guy standing next to him to shoot Lincoln on the spot.
Hmm.
And when his friend refused, Booth said, "Well, then I'll do it."
Mm-hmm.
And 2 days later went to Ford's Theater. So it really was very much on his mind, at least at that moment, and on people's minds. They understood that the vote was the heart of citizenship, and that that was the next really big step for African Americans in the South. The 15th Amendment, as you say, it took some sort of stuttering steps by the Republican Party, which was the party that fought for voting rights then, and for much of the country's history. They put through the 15th Amendment, and it had its weaknesses even then, but it led to a great flowering of democracy during Reconstruction in the South, where you had voter turnout among African Americans of 90%, and hundreds of people, African Americans, elected to legislatures and as governor and members of Congress. And then, of course, the Ku Klux Klan and other violent white vigilante groups and cynical political deals crushed that.
Mm-hmm. And took us so long to change that, didn't it?
It did, almost a century.
Yeah.
And over time, and it was not until the 1890s that these Jim Crow constitutions were put in place that really just wiped out voting rights for black people in the South. That was the central political fact in the United States for a long time, what they called the Solid South, of the Democratic Party in the South with no competition and all white, dominating Congress and much of the time other things as well.
If we had only done things differently back then, it would have been a different country if we'd only done things differently.
You know, one historian noted that a lot of countries in the 19th century ended slavery. We were the only one that tried to give the vote to the slaves that quickly, but we didn't succeed.
And as
a lot of people don't realize, people sometimes know the story of what happened in the South. There was a pushback in the North as well, not quite as total, because the North now was flooded with immigrants. They weren't immigrants from Mexico. They were from Ireland and Italy. And you hear a lot of the same things about the immigrants that you hear now. And there were a whole host of laws passed and practices undertaken to block those immigrants from being able to vote. And voter turnout really plunged. Democracy went backwards in the late 1800s. It's a lesson to remember that it doesn't only move forwards.
Mm-hmm.
So my worries about our moment right now is we shouldn't pretend to ourselves that history only moves in a positive direction.
Mm-hmm. And then you had, which is still hard to believe, my grandmother marched for the right to vote. My grandmother, it wasn't that long ago, in the streets of Chicago. You write about that whole time when, you know, people were hospitalized, when you had some incredible heroes in white horses who were leading all kinds of women to ask for the right to vote. We didn't do it until into the 20th century, for heaven's sake. Isn't that amazing?
It is amazing. And you realize that, the progressive era followed this setback for democracy. And there was a whole wave of efforts to give people the vote, to try to address the big new role of campaign money from big robber barons of the Gilded Age. And a lot of this was in Wisconsin and other places. But one of the great breakthroughs was when women won the right to vote. It doubled the size of the electorate. And we sort of skip over it in our history books. It just seems like, oh, then that happened, but then the really dramatic stuff happened later with the civil rights movement. But the women who fought for the right to vote had to fight through just as much resistance as anybody. And it was actually a handful of young women in their late 20s, some of them had been graduate students in England, who came back and said, you know what, we're going to try the audacious thing of actually passing the 19th Amendment. There had been decades of somewhat fruitless activism. And the day before his presidential inaugural, Woodrow Wilson got off the train in Washington, and there was basically nobody to greet him. The Princeton Glee Club was there, but that was about it. And at the train station, and his aide said, asked, where are all the people? And they were told they were all down at Pennsylvania Avenue, and there was a march for women's voting rights to pass the 19th Amendment. 5,000 women marching down Pennsylvania Avenue, led by, a lot of them were in sort of what we would regard as preposterous costumes, but led by a dazzling young woman named Inez Mulholland, dressed as a Greek goddess on a white horse carrying a banner.
Of course, yes. I love it.
And and surrounded on either side of Pennsylvania Avenue, there were 100,000 men.
Mm.
Many of them drunk because it was the inaugural. And the men threw things, taunts, and they broke through the lines and assaulted the women and sent 100 women to the hospital. And it was a big deal.
That is a big deal.
The police chief of Washington, D.C. had to resign. There was massive publicity. It overshadowed the inaugural in a lot of people's eyes. And public support swung toward women's suffrage. And you think about it, of course, that sounds just like Selma.
Yes.
And this was early on. The women still had to fight for several years. They had to engage in picketing and hunger strikes, all these tactics of creative, nonviolent civil disobedience before Gandhi did it, and certainly before the American labor movement or civil rights movement got fully underway. It's a period in our history that as you mentioned, I run a voting rights organization, and I have asked many of my colleagues, and they don't know the story of Alice Paul and Inez Mulholland and these other heroes. These were the John Lewis and Martin Luther King of that movement.
Yeah, they're worth a whole book, aren't they? Maybe that's the next project for you, because it's fascinating. Oh, you did 2,000 speeches. You can do another book, right?
Yeah. I'm not going to tell my family, though, if I do that.
Okay. Let's welcome phone calls for you. We have a lot more of the history to cover. And, of course, there are voting restrictions in place, the voter ID that's going on in many states in this country, and charges of voter fraud. We'll talk about voter fraud. We'll talk about the role of the courts. Interestingly, our guest says that it's not the courts who have moved us ahead for the most part in the expansion of voting rights. It's come from citizens who are demanding more accessibility to voting. Our guest is Michael Waldman. He is the author of The Right to Vote. It's The Fight to Vote. The R is crossed off and there's an F put there. He is president of the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU School of Law, where he's been for some 11 years. It's a law and policy institute working on democracy and justice. He was director of speech writing for President Bill Clinton for a number of years as well. Here's our phone number for you to join the conversation, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We are on Twitter as well, and that's at K Dunn Show. Scotty Myers will answer your phone calls, and you can chat for a little while, and then we'll chat with you on the air. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, the right fight to vote. Michael Waldman is our guest, and we go to phone calls. Angela is our first caller from Milwaukee. Hi, Angela.
Hi. Thank you for the opportunity. I'm so glad we're talking about this topic in the midst of all this Super Tuesday fallout that's going on. I recently started, I'm in the first 50 pages of Howard Zinn's A People's History of the United States, and I'm just learning about what happened a couple hundred years ago in this country when it was formed, and drawing correlations to what is currently happening in terms of certain demographics of people being suppressed in the way that they vote. And so my question really is for your guest. I'm wondering what his opinion is. Who is the candidate that is running right now that could undo this whole campaign finance Citizen United situation that's been going on for hundreds of years?
Well, as I think the caller can understand, I'm not in a position to deliver political endorsements. It is the case, though, that we're seeing these issues of democracy debated, fought over in this election in a way we have not in years and years. And that's one of the things that does give me hope. This is an election where we have, in 16 states, unfortunately, Wisconsin being one of them, these new laws that will make it harder for people to vote for the first time since the Jim Crow era, in effect for a high turnout presidential election. And adding to that the ongoing gerrymandering that makes the competition in these elections not all that meaningful, and add to that the consequences of the campaign finance system and Citizens United, and not just Citizens United, but actually other Supreme Court cases going back before that, that have given us this dystopian system where you now have the top 100 donors gave more in the last election in 2014 than the 4.75 million.
Unbelievable. That's
combined.
Amazing.
And we haven't seen something like that since the Gilded Age.
Yeah.
So, you know, it is up to all of us to demand of all the candidates at every level, so what are you going to do about it? And you're seeing in this campaign, obviously, Sanders talks about campaign finance reform as a central goal. Hillary Clinton has talked strongly about voting rights and automatic voter registration for everybody who's eligible to vote, has a good, very good campaign finance plan, hasn't talked about it as much. Even Donald Trump, who I don't think addresses it quite the same way as those other candidates, talks about the system being broken and the insiders and the lobbyists running the show, and that he's self-financing, he says, so he's, you know, he can handle that. What I want to ask all these candidates is, I don't want to know who's mad. I want to know what your plan is and what you would do about it. And it is very interesting. Hillary Clinton, before anybody else, and I believe she was joined by Bernie Sanders in saying the same thing, made it very clear that she would not nominate to the Supreme Court anybody as an appointment who did not want to overturn Citizens United and address the voting rights cases, too. Again, so you're going to see not only the Supreme Court and its role central in this election, but coming at the same time as a vacancy in some version of a nomination fight, we're going to be talking about this front and center.
Yeah. You also say, though, in the book that most of the change when it comes to expansion of voting rights has not come from the courts. It's come from citizen movements.
Yeah, isn't it? It's an interesting thing for a lot of us who grew up in the wake of some of the breakthroughs of the 60s and 50s. We tend to think of the Supreme Court as a bulwark of liberty and as a place that's going to make tremendous social progress on these kinds of issues. In fact, throughout the country's history, the courts have stayed out of it. They've washed their hands. They've said mostly that this kind of stuff is just too political to deal with. It's one of the reasons we've had so many constitutional amendments.
Mm-hmm. Four of them, haven't we?
The right to vote.
Did you say
yeah,
four?
The phrase, the right to vote, does not appear in the original Constitution, but it's appeared repeatedly since then, the 14th Amendment, the 15th Amendment, the 19th, the 24th, the 26th, other places. And it was only briefly in the 1960s when the Supreme Court, in the cases called One Person, One Vote, were very aggressive in making sure that you had every vote count equally, and so that the way legislative lines were drawn had to be fair and basically give, not tilt things toward usually rural areas. But mostly the courts have stayed out until quite recently. The Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, under John Roberts and his leadership, has been very activist and very aggressive, and especially on these democracy issues. Folks know about Citizens United, which struck down arguably a century's worth of campaign finance law. There are five other cases dealing with campaign finance where the Roberts Court has knocked down things that previously everybody thought were constitutional. And, of course, the Shelby County decision of 2013, which was the decision in which the Supreme Court gutted the Voting Rights Act of 1965, the most successful civil rights law there is. It was the opinion was not written by Justice Scalia, the late Antonin Scalia, but it was redolent of the attitude he expressed in the courtroom when he said that he thought the Voting Rights Act was nothing more than, as he put it, a racial entitlement.
Mm-hmm.
And people, you can actually, if you listen to the tape of the argument, people are actually gasping when he says that. Unfortunately, the opinion had the same consequence. And so that law, which protected so many people in so many parts of the country, is not in effect right now, again, for the first time in half a century, for a presidential election.
Yeah. What's the status of the Texas case? They issued, state-issued voter ID, and then, and you talked with some people from Texas about how they would be affected here, and then it was overturned. Is it now before the Supreme Court again?
Well, so the Texas voter ID law is one of the strictest in the country. And I should make it clear, I'm actually not against voter ID per se. I'm actually for it. I think people should have to be who they say they are and be able to prove it. But I'm against requiring ID that lots of people just don't have.
Mm-hmm.
And Texas is one of those places that did that. 2 hours after the Supreme Court's decision in the Voting Rights Act case, Texas put in place its voter ID law, and this was very mischievous in the way it was crafted. Under the Texas law, you cannot use your University of Texas ID as a government ID to vote, but you can use your concealed carry gun permit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what a coincidence. Right. The partisan consequences of that are pretty clear. And 608,000 registered voters instantly were suddenly ineligible to vote because they didn't have the right kind of paperwork, and it was overwhelmingly African-American and Latino voters. And there was a trial, and my organization, the Brennan Center for Justice, was one of the groups that sued. Federal court, after a long trial, found that this law was discriminatory, actually ruled that it was a poll tax, struck it down. The holding that it was an unlawful law was actually upheld by the most conservative federal appeals court in the country. But the law is still in effect because the state of Texas is deciding what to do next in the appeal, and they're going very slowly. And meanwhile, the law is in effect. And we don't know if that case will go to the Supreme Court. And there's another major challenge under both that and another case are using parts of the Voting Rights Act that still exist in North Carolina,
right?
Where there was a very sweeping law that's also been challenged. That could be a case that goes to the Supreme Court. And as you know, Wisconsin's voter ID law eventually was not struck down by the courts, although there are continuing challenges more narrowly targeted, and I still think that that law shouldn't be the law, and have some hope that there may be continued challenges. But as you know, that law, after being stalled for several years, will be in effect in this election.
Yes, yeah. All right, let's go to Jeff in Milwaukee. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm just concerned about a couple of things that you're saying in your quotes. When you quoted John Adams as being afraid of democracy, he wasn't afraid of democracy per se. And by the way, we don't have a democracy in this country. We are a constitutional republic. And I don't understand why yourself and guests and politicians constantly say our democracy, it's our republic. And there is a distinction. We don't have majority rule vote, which would be a democracy. We have a representative republic, which is what we have. That's why we have the Electoral College. When John Adams was afraid of democracy, he was afraid a majority rule vote would bring us back into the realm of England or elect a despot and so on. He wasn't afraid of democratic values. Okay, that was one thing. Secondly, with the quote from Thomas Jefferson, I get upset when people constantly say the proper quote, which is the people, you know, should be governed by the consent of the governed type of thing. That's how the government gets its power. And then they throw in that whole thing about he was a slave owner and so on. People tend then to overlook the message of what he was saying about consent of the governed because he was such a bad man. In the time of slavery, he actually owned slaves. Okay? The problem is with the parties today is that they give lip service to the Constitution, and then once they're elected, they do whatever they want.
Okay, Michael.
Well, on Thomas Jefferson, I am generally in agreement with the caller in the following sense. Jefferson was a slave owner, and sometimes people are brought up short by that. But it was similarly the power of his ideals as expressed in the Declaration of Independence that wound up being cited by abolitionists in arguing against slavery, and by Abraham Lincoln in the Gettysburg Address, and for that matter by Dr. King in his speech in the March on Washington. So Jefferson and his ideals were very powerful, but I think we would be kind of silly to ignore the fact that they were also flawed and hypocritical in mouthing those ideals in that particular case while being attended by a 14-year-old slave boy named Bob Hemings, who was the brother of Sally Hemings. So I revere American history. I mean, I start the book, as I have my other books, in drawing on the great democratic impulse that comes out of Jefferson's words, but I think we don't do history any service if we merely pretend that there weren't contradictions there visible even then. John Adams wasn't all that wild about democracy. If you recall, he was a great man too, but he was a Federalist, and his political party, when he was facing re-election in 1800. After passing the Alien and Sedition Laws, which I'm sure the caller would agree were pretty unconstitutional and maybe fall into the category of them getting into power and ignoring the Constitution, that basically criminalized criticism of the government, they actually tried to change the voting laws in 1800, the Federalists, to take away the popular right to vote for presidential electors because they thought they were going to lose. You've had this basic push and pull all throughout history of people who see demographic change coming or see political change coming, trying to pull up the bridges and change the rules. That started from the very beginning, too. But there really was a fear of what would happen when the motley forces arrived in the country. It's an amazing thing when you read the Constitutional Convention. They were worried about, we're going to have a lot of factory workers. Not everybody's going to be an independent farmer.
Mm-hmm.
What are we going to be like then? We're going to be like Europe.
Yeah.
And they got quite nervous, but they set in motion the idea of democracy. And, yeah, we're a republic, but we also are a democracy. And outside of high school civics classes, those aren't necessarily ideas in conflict.
Thanks, Jeff, very much for your call. We need to talk about the progressive movement for a while because, of course, Fighting Bob La Follette was from the state of Wisconsin. They gave us some significant voting reforms, didn't they?
They certainly did. And a lot of what we live with now came to us from the progressives and the progressive movement and from La Follette and others in Wisconsin. So, you know, I said earlier that things really slid backwards after this wonderful and propulsive growth in American democracy in the first part of the 1800s. By the end of the 1800s, things had really slipped backwards. And it was a time in a lot of ways like we feel today. People were angry at government. They were worried about immigration. They were worried about change. They felt government wasn't in touch with what needed to happen, and they saw a tremendous inequality in the economy, the Gilded Age of the time, that they thought put all our American values at risk. And they responded with a period of reform and revitalization that we call the Progressive Era, top to bottom, that was, you know, really quite something. And I think sometimes when we look at that era, we don't really focus quite as much on the democracy reform aspect of it. They saw part of the answer as being expanding the vote and the power of the vote. So one of the things that La Follette was especially involved in was one of the versions of campaign finance reform that they pushed, and there were more than one. Their version of McCain-Feingold was to pass the 17th Amendment to the Constitution. Previously, U.S. senators were chosen by state legislatures.
Yeah, it's hard to remember that, isn't it? I mean, I don't think many of us remember those days. Well, we were alive,
really
but...
it was really corrupt.
Yeah.
And each legislature was owned by a different industry. And so to stop that, they said, let's have the people vote. And La Follette led the fight for it in the Senate. And one of the interesting things right now, where there's a real backlash in some ways against some of these notions of democracy, I would say, on the political right in the United States right now. So that 17th Amendment, which we all kind of take for granted, there's a big push to repeal it, or at least a call to repeal it. In fact, last week, the state Senate in Utah voted to repeal the right to vote for United States Senate.
I didn't know that, really.
And Justice Scalia wanted it repealed, and their U.S. senators and Ted Cruz, they all don't think it's a very good idea. They think it takes away from states' rights.
Whew. I had no idea. Terry in Abbotsford is next for you. Hi, Terry.
Hi. I have a simple question that's been rolling around in my head. During the 60s, you know, they fought so hard to register people to vote. That's all we hear. They registered people to vote. Did those people actually get to vote? Because I am assuming that the intimidation at the polling place would have been as serious and dangerous as when you went to register to vote.
Well, it's a great question. After the Voting Rights Act of 1965, which was the great breakthrough where Dr. Martin Luther King and the civil rights movement persuaded President Johnson to push for this bill, and it passed. You had a huge increase in registration. Federal officials oversaw the registration, and over time, there actually was an increase in voting. So that by the 2008 election, black turnout in the South was higher than white turnout. Now, of course, President Obama was running.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the reasons, but that's okay. I mean, that's politics. So turnout really, it took a while, but that kind of naked intimidation really did not prove to be as much of a problem. And at the same time, that change in who votes scared a lot of people. And we have a country that's changing demographically. And if you look at the states where the most onerous new voting laws have been enacted, not all of them, but they tend to be states where there was a bigger than average increase in voting by communities of color and a sort of backlash against that. So I think that, you know, it is the case that one of the biggest obstacles to participation is registration. And I'm very hopeful that this idea of automatic and permanent voter registration, I mentioned that Hillary Clinton has a proposal for that. There's actually exciting movement in a number of states. In California and Oregon passed a version of this. New mm-hmm. Jersey's legislature passed it, but Governor Christie vetoed it. To basically say that everybody who's eligible to vote gets registered by the government and stays in the rolls, it minimizes the possibility of fraud, and it would add tens of millions of people to the rolls. Then it's up to all of us to vote, because turnout is so low for so many reasons.
Sure is.
And some of it is all of our fault for not being active enough, but there are obstacles as well.
We're speaking this hour with Michael Waldman. Michael is the author of The Fight to Vote, and he is the president of the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU School of Law. He was director of speechwriting for President Bill Clinton from 95 to 99. Our phone number, and we have one line open right now, 800-486-8655. You can also send us an email, talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page, we love to read your messages. We do indeed, is the Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Richard in Madison is next. Hello, Richard.
Hello. Thank you for letting me call.
Sure.
Back in 2011, I read, I think, in Nation magazine, an article exposing Alec as the prime mover for all of these restrictions on voting. Is that mentioned in your book?
Absolutely. So ALEC, so that folks know, is the American Legislative Exchange Council, and it's an organization that is a conservative group, and it pushes and writes legislative proposals for state legislators all over the country. And so much of the governing of America takes place in state capitals, not in Washington. And ALEC, most of the time, sort of works on business issues and tax issues, but they began pushing voter ID laws and a lot of laws that were sort of very similar that passed all at once in 2011. And ALEC is interesting in a few different ways. ALEC helps serve in a way as a key to the political strategy behind a lot of these laws. ALEC was founded by a man named Paul Weyrich, a tremendously effective organizer. Weyrich also co-founded the Heritage Foundation, which is one of the most effective popularizers of the idea that there must be tons of voter fraud out there. And Weyrich gave a speech in 1980. This is a key moment in the birth of our current political era, or at least the recent political era. Ronald Reagan had been nominated by the Republican Party, and he was speaking to the evangelicals for the first time. And Weyrich sort of warmed up the crowd, and he said, I don't want everyone to be able to, some people want everyone to be able to vote. I don't want everyone to be able to vote. In fact, the more people vote, the worse we do. That was his political strategy, and the organizations he founded have pursued that strategy. And now, decades later, we're all living in some respects with the consequences.
Thank you very much, Richard, for the call. I know this is different in state to state, Michael, but Jackie sent an email wondering about the number of people who can't vote in states because of felony convictions. Do we need reform on that front?
Yes, we do. That is an area where there has been very encouraging progress, but it's nonetheless a blot on our democracy. We have over 2.5 million people, I believe, nationwide, who are unable to vote because in the past they've had a felony conviction. And I'm not talking about people in prison. I'm talking about people back in the community, paying taxes, doing their thing, and still unable to vote. This is a remnant, in some respects, of the Jim Crow era, although it actually predates that. And as we understand better how our criminal justice system needs to be changed, that we have mass incarceration where we have 5% of the world's population and 25% of the world's prison population, we realize that more and more people got their right to vote taken away that who maybe shouldn't have even had that criminal conviction in the first place. The good news is there's a movement around the country to do something about this, and it is not partisan. It is left and right. The Brennan Center works on this, and so do the evangelicals, the conservative evangelicals, who are quite active, actually, in criminal justice reform, and this is sort of a part of that. Rand Paul is one of the leading spokespeople for this kind of reform in the Congress. And there are the two states with the biggest population where it is still the case that it's a lifetime ban on voting. If you had a criminal conviction when you were 18, you can't vote ever for the rest of your life. One of them is Florida. The other is Virginia. And so many people in Florida are affected. It has affected election outcomes.
I would imagine it would. Let's go to Bob next in Shawano. Hi, Bob.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Now, I sent a Yahoo, or not a Facebook notice here about this, but I'm lucky to get on anyhow. I just made the comment that my son and his family live in New Zealand, and they're immigrants. And a while back, they received notices that there was voter registration. And then after a short time, they got another note said, you haven't registered yet. And so they were required to register to vote. And they're not citizens, they're just immigrants.
Well, and in Australia, right next door, it's mandatory to vote. Other democracies do it much better than we do in some ways. Look, we're very proud of our democracy. It's the world's oldest. It's been a great source of renewal for the country, but there are ways in which it's ramshackle. And this voter registration system, I think, is one of the chief among them. Hmm. Another somewhat scary thought, as you may remember, you know, there was the Florida recount.
I remember.
And how crazy that was, and the election was decided in the end by the Supreme Court, mm-hmm. but it was really a tie, you know. It was down to 537 votes, and what that revealed was just how shaky the machinery of the elections were. It helped make the partisans understand why it would be in their interest to try to either increase turnout or suppress the vote, depending on their goals. But one of the things that happened was Congress required that all the states buy electronic voting machines. And that's what happened. And a lot of people were very worried about those machines and the security problems. And those have mostly been fixed. I mean, I don't think people have any genuinely have a legitimate worry to have that somewhere Karl Rove is sitting in a room pushing a button in the Diebold headquarters and you know, switching all the votes to his favorite candidate. So that's actually something of a success story, but there's only one problem. These are 15-year-old computers.
Huh.
Yeah. They all could break.
Mm-hmm.
And in 43 states, the voting machines, which are computers, are over 10 years old.
Could I make an additional comment here?
Yeah, go ahead, Bob.
I read this in the Harper's magazine. They have Harper's Index with a bunch of little odd facts and so on. Percentage of Americans over 35 who believe that living in a democracy is essential, 55%.
Hmm.
I thought that was kind of scary. The next sentence, of Americans aged 18 to 35, 29%.
Hmm.
And this was apparently from an article from a guy at the Harvard School of Business, mm-hmm. so it's not, they pulled it off.
I wonder if I'm not sure I believe those numbers. I mean, there's no way to know, and I'd be interested in seeing the results. I think people have a deep yearning for the sense of power and self-worth that comes from a meaningful democracy. I think also that there's a continued strength in this patriotic American ideal that this is who we are. I think people don't necessarily believe they're living in one. Voter turnout in the last election was the lowest
it's
been.
Yeah.
The lowest in 72 years.
Wow, 72 years. Goodness.
Yeah, it's, you know, and it tends to go up in presidential elections. But even in this crazy election, turnout has not been so high. But I think we're seeing in this primary season, Americans are expressing their unhappiness with the situation. They're focusing not only on what government does, but how the system works.
Mm-hmm.
They're doing it in different ways. I don't like all the ways they're doing it. But I think you hear from the voters, from the public to the leaders, a real scream of unhappiness in this election. Part of the question will be, do the leaders respond? And how does the political system respond when the voters, in effect, crash the party?
Yeah.
That's why the elections are so important, because it's a steam valve that we're lucky we have.
Yeah, it's a wonderful thing to be able to vote. Less than a minute. Kate from Holman, hi.
Hello. I'll make this short.
Okay.
I know you're almost done. This is an aside. For the people who do vote, I'm very worried about, I'm from Wisconsin, and our last assembly and what the government signed was done behind closed doors. Nobody could come in. There were no hearings on the majority of the bills. That, to me, is kind of a voting rights, too, because if I can't go and speak up, I feel like my voting rights are not honored. And I'm curious to see what Michael thinks about.
All right, we have about 20 seconds for that, Michael. I'm sorry.
I was going to say, I live in New York City, and Albany, by comparison, makes what you've described, what you're living in a paradise. I think you're exactly right. State capitals, where so much of the governing happens, are not subject to accountability. There's very little of the kind of newspaper coverage there used to be.
Yeah, that's for sure. We need to go, Michael. Thank you. Thank you so much for being with us and for writing this history. The book is The Fight to Vote. Michael Waldman, our guest, he is president of the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU School of Law.